All right, the first case this morning is United States versus Barker. Mr. Frederick?
May it please the court, my name is Tom Frederick, and I'm the counsel appointed by this court to represent the defendant, Ricos Barker, in this appeal. In my presentation to the court this morning, I intend to focus on the first argument in our briefs, which concerns the denial of Mr. Barker's Sixth Amendment right to counsel, and rely on our briefs for our remaining arguments unless the court has questions regarding those arguments. So let me turn to our Sixth Amendment argument. As the court knows, the Sixth Amendment mandates that a criminal defendant has a right to assistance of counsel for his defense. The Sixth Amendment right specifically includes, as this court has stated, a right to counsel, quote, whose undivided loyalties lie with his client, unquote. And that's the Ellison case, 798 F. 2nd at 1106.
Mr. Frederick, before you get too much further into this, I have a question about how your argument right now on this point relates to your effort in your brief to reserve other Sixth Amendment issues. Because in our decision in the United States against Ziegenhagen, which you certainly cite frequently, when you look at the box, if you will, when you look at the category under which this court is analyzing the right to representation free of any conflicts, the opinion for the court says, generally speaking, ineffective assistance of counsel claims are governed by Strickland and so on and so forth. It's under the general thought about ineffective assistance of counsel. And I'm not familiar with any law that says you can raise some ineffective assistance of counsel claims on direct appeal and save other ineffective assistance counsels of claims for 2255. And in fact, to the contrary, we've said it's really just one big generic, did you get effective assistance of counsel, and it's assessed as a whole. So if you can explain to me why it is you think we can split it up like that, I would appreciate it.
Yes, I will, Your Honor. It's a unique case. This case does not rely, unlike your typical ineffective assistance of counsel claim, it does not rely on establishing that Mr. Barker's trial counsel, Robert Gevers, actually committed an error at trial.
But let me just say, if we were to address this aspect, I mean, I understand you're going to explain to us why the record is good enough to handle this right now. But if we accept your argument and decide this problem right now, have we not shut the door to anything else under the Sixth Amendment? Why do you think you can reserve something for later? Maybe there isn't anything to reserve. Maybe he doesn't care. But it seems to me it's all or nothing. We either do the Sixth Amendment now or we don't.
Well, Your Honor, if it's, I'd like to submit it's not all or nothing. But if it's all or nothing, I also want to be very clear that Mr. Barker has instructed us that if this appeal is unsuccessful, he does intend to bring a habeas petition. So if the court decides this is all or nothing, I'd be compelled to withdraw on this argument here this morning. Okay. I don't think that's necessary. The record and to get to the court's point, this is the same situation as Ziegenhagen. Except here, the conflict came to the attention of the trial court, whereas in Ziegenhagen, it only came to the attention of the appellate court when Mr. Ziegenhagen filed a pro se motion. But in Ziegenhagen, in another case, this court has held that the record was sufficiently developed, establishing the conflict, to rule on the issue. Now, if the court is telling me...
Well, the cases since then have seemed to go the other way, though, haven't they?
There have certainly been cases not involving this precise conflict that have gone the other way. Yes, Your Honor.
And it is that's because we've said it's all or nothing.
Virtually, and that's what I respectfully am arguing for an exception to that all or nothing rule when you have a prosecutor conflict like this.
How did you bring it to the attention of the district court? How was it brought to the attention?
We moved to supplement the trial record. The first indication that anyone connected to the trial was aware of this conflict came when the defendant's mother wrote a letter to the court after trial posing the question, Judge Springman, do you believe that he got a fair trial when he was represented by I'm paraphrasing, the counsel who prosecuted him previously. Up until that time, there's certainly indications in the record that everyone knew that Mr. Devers was a former prosecutor, but that's not an issue, really. I mean, obviously there are lots of former prosecutors turned defense counsel. It did not come to the attention of anyone until we took on this appeal.
But that's the letter. I mean, insofar as there was a proffer, that letter is before us. But that letter is not part of the record, is it?
That letter is it's noticed to the trial court. Again, in Ziegenhagen.
But isn't that part of the set of documents that you moved unsuccessfully both in the trial court and here to have actually added to the record?
We certainly did move unsuccessfully, Your Honor. We're asking the court to take judicial notice under Federal Rule of Evidence 201.
Well, not of the letter. I thought the judicial notice was
of the records. That's right. No, the record. I'm sorry. Then I misunderstood the court's question. No, the letter, we didn't make any motion for respect. It's in the record.
So
it was part of the trial court record below.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's the other stuff that the government's complaining, the docket sheets from Indiana and so on.
That's right, Your Honor. So in any event, to answer your question, if the court has instructed me it's all or nothing, then it's nothing today, and I'll move on. But I would like to, unless the court's instructing me that it's all or nothing presently.
Well, we have done that in the past with counsel and saying you better save it for another day. I don't know how my colleagues will feel about giving that instruction this morning, but we have taken that position in the past.
All right.
Well, here, I will just add to the mix the fact that at least in Ziegenhagen, from a different all-or-nothing point of view, what we said was, in this case, the prosecutorial role that Ziegenhagen's counsel took in the earlier convictions was substantial enough to represent an actual conflict of interest. And I'm highlighting that just because I can't tell myself, looking at the pages that you've proffered, at least, how substantial Mr. Giever,
I'm going with Giever's, Your Honor.
All right, Giever's role was. And, of course, as you well know, anything that needs further factual development really is prudently saved for the 2255.
And if the court believes, and I'd submit based on the records we have, his apparent conflict is more substantial than that in Ziegenhagen. He was the prosecuting attorney of Allen County, whose office convicted Mr. Barker on six occasions.
He was the elected chief of the office.
He was, Your Honor.
Whether he participated in the affair other than to make the decision or sign the indictment, it's not in the record.
That is not in the record, Your Honor.
I think we're getting to the point, maybe you can feel it.
I do feel it, Your Honor.
It's not developed enough for us to...
All right. Then I'm going to withdraw that issue. And I'll proceed to our Brady argument, if the court pleases.
Thank you.
Mr. Barker was denied his Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial because the government violated the requirements of Brady v. Maryland, which, of course, requires the government to produce exculpatory evidence in a timely fashion. The violation here took place when, during trial, in Mr. Giever's cross-examination of an agent from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, Agent Skender. Agent Skender disclosed that he had interview notes from an interview he had conducted from the gun store clerk who had sold the guns in question. When those interview notes were produced to the trial judge immediately identified exculpatory information in the notes and ordered that they be produced to the defendant. The defendant also moved for a mistrial at that point. The notes conflicted in significant part with the government's theory of the case, including directly with the testimony of one of the government's chief witnesses, Nikesha Lovelace, who had testified that the defendant had accompanied her to the store, that they alone went into the store, that she purchased the guns at the defendant's direction. Ms. Dyer's interview notes revealed that, according to Ms. Dyer's, there were four people in the store, two women, one man, and one child. Also, she was called to testify by the defense after these notes were disclosed and the mistrial motion was withdrawn, and she testified that she could not recognize the defendant when she saw him in court the day before because the government had asked her to show up in court and see if she could ID him, and she couldn't do that.
But see, that was my concern about this argument. It's certainly not that there wasn't something potentially exculpatory, but at the end of the day, even if not at quite the right moment in the trial, this evidence does come out in the trial. And I take it that your argument is the more subtle argument, that it should have come out a little sooner and therefore you would have been able to use it more effectively. But is that enough to show a Brady violation at all? If it's produced, you have some time to think about it, you get to call the witness, the jury hears the information.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. I mean, this substantially prejudiced the defense by requiring that this evidence was not available again until the middle of trial. There was no opportunity to use this evidence in cross-examining the government's witnesses who came on before this point. And I mean, you know,
could you have recalled anybody?
Perhaps Mr. Devers could have recalled someone.
I mean, you personally, obviously,
yeah.
The defense.
Yeah. I mean, that's a possibility, but the fact remains everyone recognized this was a violation of Brady at the time, and it occurred in the middle of trial with respect to critical evidence, because basically Ms. Dyer's testimony is Mr. Barker wasn't there. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least she can't say he was there, and she also directly conflicted with the testimony of Nakisha Lovelace as to who was in the store and who directed the purchases. Thank you, Your Honor. I reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Whitaker. Mr. Fettig, thank you. Mr. Haller.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I believe the first issue has been withdrawn, so I'll move directly to the second issue in this case. On the Brady argument, the standard in this case is whether the defense had sufficient time to make effective use of the material in question. And there's no doubt that the defense in this case did have sufficient time to make use of the material. As soon as the information was disclosed, Mr. Gevers moved for a mistrial, and Judge Springman made, I believe, the commendable decision to take a recess at 3 o'clock, give the defense time to decide exactly what it was that it wanted to do. What the defense elected to do was to take advantage of the remainder of that evening to locate Ms. Dyers, to interview her, and to use her as best as possible to be set up as a contradictory witness to Ms. Lovelace, to also use that opportunity to try to make whatever hay it could with the jury out of the circumstances. I have no doubt, Your Honor, that if Mr. Gevers had thought as a tactical matter that the better course was to seek a mistrial, that Judge Springman would have given him that option. But what he's attempting to do now is get a second bite of the apple. He made the strategic choice to go forward under the circumstances, was given a fair and effective trial, and now would like to have a second one. And under the standards that this course has set out in O'Hara and Walton, if there's a continuance that's been offered and sufficient time that has been made available for the defense to use that information, then that's what the constitutional standard requires.
Well, Mr. Gevers did move for a mistrial, didn't he? And then he withdrew the motion.
He moved for a mistrial at 3 o'clock. He asked for the judge to look at the report in camera. Judge Springman and Mr. Gevers both followed all of the procedures that have been set forth by this court. The material was reviewed in camera. Judge Springman made a determination that the information should be turned over. Mr. Gevers looked at the report. Mr. Gevers moved for a mistrial at the end of the first day. Judge Springman said, I think we should wait. I think we should, let's take a recess. Let's let you talk to your client. Let's let you decide what you want to do with it. And we'll come back in the morning. And if you want a mistrial, we'll take that motion up then. But I think Judge Springman wanted to look at the issue as well before she made a determination as to what was going to happen. Then when they come in the next morning, on page 2 of the second transcript, she takes the bench, and Mr. Gevers has talked to Ms. Dyers. He's had the night to think about what's going to be the best strategy here. And the best strategy, frankly, probably was to go forward. The defense wants to make it look like Ms. Dyers and Nakisha Lovelace testified in directly opposite ways. In many respects, their testimony meshes. Ms. Lovelace actually was never asked the question, who was in the gun store with you? She was never asked that question. She was asked at one point, who was in the car when you were talking with Mr. Barker about using this false ID? And she says, myself, Karendi Barker, and the defendant. And then there was sort of a leading question that was asked, and did you and Mr. Barker go into the store? Well, yes, we did. And then that's it. That's the end of the discussion. Now, Mr. Barker himself, in the statement that he gave to the special agent, said, I was in the store with Nakisha Lovelace and my girlfriend, Kenosha Haney, who also is kind of always in this case, she's although never as a defendant, but she's peppered frequently throughout. And that's the person who was also in the store. Now, on direct examination, before the government knew that Amanda Deers was going to be the defense's star witness, that wasn't a particularly important fact. But if this case had been mistried, and now we have a new trial, you can bet that that question would have been asked of Nikesha Lovelace. So under the circumstances, a strategic choice was made as to how to proceed. And that, under the standard, was there sufficient time to make use of the material? The answer is clearly yes, there was. So it does not rise to a Brady violation that would justify a new trial. So we believe.
And what about recalling the witnesses? I understood their argument to be yes, they used the material in a certain with Ms. Dyer's own testimony, but their cross examination would have been different.
Well, I understand that in the vaguest sense they do state that, but the question is one could always say that. In that case, I would think O'Hara and Walton and all of these other cases would have come out differently. And I believe my reading of those cases is that the court says, number one, if you've been given the choice and you're making the most effective use of your material, that's enough to satisfy the standard. They did recall Special Agent Skender. They recalled Special Agent Skender as before they called Ms. Dyers, essentially to say, didn't you have this report? And I just saw this report for the first time after the jury left yesterday, to make it look as bad as they possibly could. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt that if the government was not in any position at that point in time in this trial to make any kind of restrictions on the ability to recall Ms. Lovelace under any kind of separation orders or anything like that. If the defense had wanted Ms. Lovelace back on the stand, if the defense had wanted additional time, I don't think that there's any doubt she could have been put back on the stand. And she wasn't put back on the stand because the contradictions may well have disappeared. But that was a call for the defense to make. There's nothing in the record that shows, hey, you're going to be restricted from Ms. Lovelace. Ms. Lovelace was friends with Ms. Haney, who was Mr. Barker's girlfriend. She could have been put back on the stand. She was cross-examined fairly effectively even without the report. The defense, it would seem to me if the defense could point to a question that was asked of Ms. Lovelace and say, hey, we would not have asked this question had we known Ms. Dyers was going to say X, that's fine. But the defense couldn't have gotten up there under evidence anyway and said, isn't it true that Ms. Dyers said X, Y, Z, you know, in this report? That's not a proper method of impeachment. Calling Ms. Dyers is. So that's what was done in this case. If the court has questions on the other issues, on the suppression issue, Your Honor, we believe that Judge Springman's order almost speaks for itself. Based on the factual findings that she made, the defendant was not the equivalent of under formal arrest or in custody when he made these particular statements. He arrived at the ATF agent and consented to talk. He was informed he was not under arrest and free to leave. He was not taken from the street and moved to the office. He showed up on his own. He departed without hindrance. The defense wants to try to make it look like armed people escorted him into the interior bowels of the ATF office. And based on the factual findings of Judge Springman, that's simply not the case. The guns were concealed under the individual's coats and were never even seen by the defendants. And the conference room in question was 3 to 5 feet away from the entrance. Even in cases like, I'll mispronounce this, but California versus Behler, where
you mispronounced California, did you?
I hope I know how to pronounce California, Your Honor. What? I hope I know how to pronounce Illinois more, but California as well. And under Mathiasen, any sort of misrepresentation that was made certainly wasn't along the level of Mathiasen. There was nothing there that would make this a custodial interrogation that would require Miranda warnings. And on the sentencing issues,
Your opponent gets to rebut what you're talking about. You're raising issues that aren't discussed. I'm just curious.
On the sentencing issues, I said I was going to stand on my brief. So
that away.
If that opens the door, then I apologize that it opens the door. If the court has further questions on any of the issues, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, we would stand on our brief.
Thank you, Mr. Holler. Mr. Frederick?
Door is open.
4 minutes, Mr. Frederick.
Thank you, Your Honor. First and foremost, let me read into the record the actual testimony from Nikesha Lovelace at trial, which points out how critical Dyer's testimony was. This is from the long appendix starting at page 262, line 18. Question, who was all in the car? Answer, me, Corindi, Riakos, and I don't remember nobody else. Question, Okay, and why wasn't Corendi making this purchase? Answer, because she had to go to work. Question, so she didn't go into the gun store? Answer, no. Question, did you drop her anywhere before going to the gun store? Answer, to work. Question, you and Ricos proceeded to the gun store? Answer, yes. I submit to the court that testimony establishes that according to Nikisha Lovelace, there are only two people in the store that she went in the store with, and that was herself and Mr. Barker. Ms. Dyer's testimony and statement that wasn't produced until the middle of the trial was directly contrary. There were four people in the store, two women, one man, one child. The man had took no active role in the purchases. That's directly contrary to Lovelace's testimony. And I just want to submit to the court that under this testimony, remember, before the defense got this statement, put yourself in Mr. Giever's shoes. You've got the testimony of a government agent, which obviously the defense theory that was not correct testimony, but you've got the testimony of a government agent, and you've got the testimony of Ms. Lovelace that is consistent with the testimony of the government agent, and you've got whatever your client is telling you, which is obviously different than that, and there's another issue as to why Mr. Barker didn't testify I'm not going to go into today. We'll wait for subsequent proceedings. But the point is, the testimony at trial was directly, this testimony of Ms. Lovelace is directly contrary to Ms. Dyer's statement and her subsequent testimony at trial. Now, to the court's point, the question that, well, it got in, yeah, it got in, but it's a trial, all right? It's a trial before a jury of 12 people, and the dynamic is a lot different if this is coming in subsequent to the cross-examination of the government witnesses than during at the outset of the trial, and everyone knows up front that this testimony is coming in.
That may be true. I don't disagree that there's probably some difference at the margin, but you know, the courts like to say things like you're entitled to a fair trial, not a perfect trial, and things along those lines. And even if it wasn't ideal, isn't the question for us at this point whether it's enough?
And I'm submitting it's not enough, Your Honor. I mean, this was the defense theory was Mr. Barker wasn't there. And Ms. Dyer's testimony was the best evidence we have of that. Again, four people in the store, not two. Couldn't ID Mr. Barker as being the man in the store, and this was not produced before trial. This is not, you know, I understand the motion was withdrawn. This is an unwaivable, this is plain error. Mr. Barker did not go on the record and say, yeah, I understand the consequences of withdrawing this motion. I understand all that. I'm going to withdraw the motion. This was fundamental to his defense, and it should mandate reversal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Frederick, and thank you and your firm for taking on the assignment in this case. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.